phone line open.
It is March 27th, 9 a.m. This is the GNSO Privacy and Proxy Services Accreditation Issues Working Group in the Sophia Room. Thank you.
Okay, why don't we get started? Oh, yes. I haven't run a session at NICAN before. It took me a while to get used to running phone calls, so if we could get the recording started, please.
There's plenty of room at the table for those of you in the chairs at the back if you care to join us up here.
This is the open meeting of the Privacy Proxy Services Accreditation Issues PDP Working Group, our first open session since we began work not long after the Buenos Aires meetings. I'm Don Blumenthal, the chair of the group. Graham Button to my left, who's one of the vice chairs. Steve Metallitz is the other one. He is couldn't make the trip, but I understand he's on the phone. Why don't we just do a roll call of committee members who are here? Start. I can't see who's on which end, so starting that way. Yeah.
This is Omar El-Assad from the Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, and I'm a member of this working group.
Marika Konings, ICANN staff.
Avri Doria, NCSG, just observing.
Oswaldo Novoa, ISPCP.
Christina Rosette, IPC.
Margie Milam, ICANN staff.
Graham Bunton from Two Cows, vice chair.
Don Blumenthal, I work for Public Interest Registry, but not representing the stakeholder group.
Mary Wong, ICANN staff.
James Bladel, GoDaddy, we're a registrar.
Cake, Electronic Frontiers Australia, NCSG, working group member.
Alex Deakin with the MPAA, IPC.
Griffin Barnett, IPC, working group member.
Morning, Marie-Laure Lumineux with MPOC.
Pranish Prakash, I'm with NCUC, and I'm just an observer.
Phil Morano, Cat and Mution, IPC.
Any members in the seats back there? I have an eye doctor appointment about a month after the conference. I'll be in better shape next time. Okay. We're going to do some just kind of setup explanation of what we've been doing, who we are for people who are not on the committee. Then have a presentation about the proxy privacy survey of the expert working group, which we have not had a chance to see, really, because it was released right before people started departing wherever they were, departing home to come here. And we're going to, we kind of decided to forego a formal working meeting in the interest of having, leaving time for public comments. We can talk about all the issues among us, but after a while, it's the same voices not the same perspective necessarily, but we know who we are, and it's nice to get new comments, new observations. So I hope that people who are here who are not on the committee will take the opportunity to speak up. Okay, yeah, let me take a minute to give people who are on the phone who are members of the committee a chance to introduce themselves, either on the phone or in Adobe Connect.
Hi, this is Steve Metallitz with the IPC, vice chair.
You see anyone else? Okay.
There's more people Hello. In the there's more people in the Adobe Connect that are introducing themselves.
Okay, Mary, could you read out who's introducing themselves on Adobe Connect, the members?
Yeah, there's several people in Adobe Connect who presumably are not able to join us in person, including several members of the working group. One is Tatiana Kramzova, as well as Todd Williams. Tatiana is from RU Center. She's a registrar representative. And Todd Williams is from the IPC. There's also Brian Winterfeld, also IPC and counselor to the GNSO Council.
Okay, well, let me just take one more minute to let latecomer committee members introduce themselves.
Hello, Volker Greimann, Key Systems, and GNSO Counselor.
We also have Norm Ritchie from Secure Domain Foundation, who's just joined us in Adobe Connect.
Paul McGrady from Winston & Strawn. I removed my badge because it contained personal information.
You could have just paid someone to put a sticky note over your badge.
Okay. One last chance to do an self-introduction.
Thank you. This is Maria Farrell. I'm from the Non-Commercial Stakeholders Group.
Okay. With that, let's get to...
Stephanie Barron, Non-Commercial Stakeholders Group.
Apologies, Stephanie. I couldn't recognize who it was down there. Okay, that's it. Anybody else who comes in is anonymous. So I guess that's proxy instead of privacy, huh? I'm going to go, I think, without slides here, except for a couple of crib notes for myself. We have been in business roughly, as I mentioned, since right after Buenos Aires. But a lot of the work done in 2013 was organizational. And obviously, as with every group, a lot of time just kind of disappeared with the onset of the holidays. So I think it's fair to say we really just got started at the beginning of this year. So we're not quite effectively 3 months into our work. There's a lot of the GNSO gave us a lot of issues to address. Some of them are relatively straightforward. Some are really very complex. So at this point, I think we're probably looking at a report in a draft report a year from now, a little bit less. This is not going to be a quick process by a long shot. I hope I'm wrong, but that's just realistic expectation. Can you take that? The group is kind of an outgrowth of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement of 2013 that effectively put proxy privacy services in the system officially. But the decision was made to include provisions for privacy and proxy in the agreement, but defer until there was a defer operational decisions to this working group. Our task is to come up with policy guidance on accreditation issues. The details will be worked out afterwards. there's a temporary privacy proxy set of privacy proxy items in the RAA, because obviously the 2013 agreement is in place and moving ahead. Kind of like the new GTLD program, a lot's temporary. But then it's our task to make it, to really lock down the terms and conditions and requirements. We took the set of questions that the GNSO gave us and organized them into groupings. Roughly, I'd say, well, our overall groupings were issues related to maintenance, registration processes, relay and reveal, and then termination termination of service. Once we organized things, we sent questionnaires out to the SOs and ACs and SGs and whatever else I'm missing here to get their input into the questions. We didn't get a lot back, but we did get some answers from groups that traditionally seem to be the most interested in who is issues, such as the NCSG and the IPC. We are going through those, and they'll be part of our deliberations. At the same time, we've heard presentations from staff, we've heard presentations from members of various, so far I guess only one, from various members of the registrar community who are on the committee largely for the purpose of just educating work group members. You can't really address these issues properly without really understanding how the industry works, how registrars operate. So we've had those briefings specifically from James Bladel and Volker Greiman. I suspect there'll be others as we go along. Again, we need to educate ourselves as we go along on the issues. Staff pulled together information, kind of a sampling of terms of existing proxy privacy services, again, to guide our work. We've reached out to the CC community because a number of the CC TLDs already have existing formalized proxy privacy operations. And with all that going on, we actually do our own work. We have the GNSO questions organized, as I mentioned, and go through them methodically on each call and on our mailing list. As we go along, staff puts together kind of a template cataloging the comments that come in that way. And through the templates, we come up with what we think are the beginning, and let me stress that, beginning of consensus positions. We'll go through these again week by week, but periodically revisiting, because sometimes we've already come to issues early on and looked at them and realized, you know, we can't look at this until we look at something that's not going to happen, we're not going to even examine for a few months. So this will be a process of moving forward, but then looking back. excuse me, travel does my voice, does some ugly things to my voice. We'll have another session like this in London, in Los Angeles, and in addition to looking at things ourselves, we will consistently reach out for thoughts of interested and educated, when I say that, I mean people involved in the processes, communities, so that our work is as informed as possible. Any questions on what I've laid out here before we move on to discussion of the EWG survey? Okay. Margie Milam's here from ICANN staff, who is also the primary staff person for the EWG. So why don't I step back?
Thank you, Don. What I'm going to provide to you today is a summary of the findings from the privacy proxy questionnaire that we put out in January on behalf of the EWG. As you may recall, the members of this working group did provide some comments on how to phrase the questions and address some of the content. Do we have a clicker? Okay. Next slide, please. We were fortunate in that we got 58 respondents. So that's a fairly sizable amount, although they immediately, most of them dropped after the first question when they realized how much information we were asking for. But so this slide shows the breakdown of the 58 respondents and what kind of services they provided. Essentially, the summary we're talking about here, because there were only really 11 true responses, isn't statistically significant. I think it's more illustrative of the types of practices that are out there. So I just wanted to mention that. And so if you look at the slide, it describes the kind of services that they provide with respect to this topic. You've got 43% that are resellers, 74% were registrars, and then the breakdown between privacy and proxy providers were 41% considered themselves a proxy provider and 66% considered themselves a privacy provider. Next slide, please. And so we asked a series of questions and to try to get a sense for the practices that are used by privacy and proxy services. James?
I'm sorry, did you want us to hold our questions till the end? I had a question on the previous slide, but I'm willing to wait if that's...
No, go ahead. I think it's probably easier to do it during the presentation.
Okay, thanks. Sure. I wasn't sure what our protocol was here. So just two quick questions here. When you say that there were reseller or registrar, these are self-identified. Okay, yes. So it's not necessarily that we're getting information that the proxy service itself is the same entity as the registrar or the reseller, or an affiliated, is that coming later? Or
We didn't go into that level of detail, so we weren't trying to identify affiliates.
And same thing with the term proxy or privacy. For example, in our company, we use the name proxy,
right?
In the private, but we call it a privacy service, so that's also a self-identified term. All right, thanks.
Yeah, and in fact, when we looked at some of the responses, what we thought were proxy services were described by some as privacy services. So I think there's a bit of confusion in the industry regarding what those terms mean.
Well, I think proxy is a technical term.
This is Steve Metallitz. Could I ask a question?
Go ahead, Steve.
On the summary slide, proxy and privacy numbers add up to more than 100%. Does that mean that some people identified themselves as both?
There may have been some that offered both. I didn't look at the raw data. Lisa Pfeiffer, our consultant, actually looked at the raw data, so I don't have the answer to that.
Kathy? Or were you, James, were you following up?
Oh, yeah, just a point that I don't know that it's industry confusion so much as that when selling these products, the idea or the distinctions between privacy and proxy are usually not interesting or material to the average consumer, and so I think you'll see both of them marketed as privacy services because that's more readily understood.
Certainly if you do a Google search on privacy services, once you read more deeply, you realize it's proxy, as I found out. Kathy?
Yeah, I was just thinking this slide would be really useful if there were absolute numbers next to each bar so that we knew how many services thought they were private, you know, of the 58 respondents, how that goes. Thank you.
I can say for people who are, do it myself, for people who are speaking, please speak into the mic.
That would be a really good idea, wouldn't it?
And if you actually look at the survey summary, this is just a slide, a summary of the summary. It has the breakdown of the 58, so you can take a look at that document. I think, Mariko, it's been circulated or posted? Yeah, okay. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so one of the questions related to the privacy and proxy service contracts and the kinds of customer support. And so now these responses, as I mentioned, are the 11 that provided details. And from that, it appeared that 7 of them provided their customer contact information online, but only 2 of them included telephone numbers. Some of the other responses we received were that the contacts were not published because they varied by TLD and by customer. That was one response. Another response was that the provider contact information constantly changes and is not posted on the website for that reason. So, interesting responses. Any questions or comments on that? Okay, next slide, please.
Yeah, this is Steve Metallitz. I'm trying to understand that last one. Is this someone who said, was a provider and said, our contact information constantly changes, so we're not going to tell anybody how to contact us?
That their contact information changes, but presumably they didn't feel the need to to update their website or to have it be on their website. Yeah, it's interesting.
Okay, but this slide refers to how the customer would contact the service, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Volker?
This could also refer to services that, like ours, have a fixed set of data, but one point of data always changes. For example, in our case, the email address is generated automatically every time a Whois inquiry is made. So every Whois inquiry gets their own email address to use, which expires after 14 days. That ensures that no harvesting of Whois data can occur, and the email address can still be used to forward directly to the registrant.
This is Steve. That's why I asked that question. This is not about that. It's not about the information about the customers. This is the information the customers can use to contact the service. Is that, if I understand the Margie's earlier answer correctly, it doesn't have anything to do with what's presented and Whois. Or did I misunderstand that?
No, oh, yeah, that would be my misunderstanding.
That's right. That's right, Steve. Your understanding is correct, but it's possible that the responder didn't understand the question. So it could be that this, they misread the question to ask about the contact information for the domain name versus the contact for the service itself. Okay, next slide, please. So we asked about what the contact information looks like depending upon this type of service. And as you can see, they gave some typical examples of what the information would look like. I won't read it. I think this is probably consistent with what you understand, from what a privacy service would provide or what a proxy service would provide. Next slide, please. So essentially what the providers do is they use the following methods to protect the customer contact details. They will substitute the provider's name as the registrant's name, you see that obviously in a proxy service. They substitute the provider's postal address as the registrant's tech admin and registrant postal address. And they'll substitute the provider's email address or sometimes provide a unique forwarding email address. I think that's what Volker was referring to. Or they'll substitute the provider's telephone and fax number for the registrants, or in some cases provide a unique forwarding number. And so one provider indicated that they substitute all of the details for non-identifiable information that's unique to the domain name and to the client. And then another provider indicated that they'll sometimes indicate that it's registered on behalf of the domain owner. So I think they're trying to, clarify that. Any questions on this slide or comments? Okay, next slide, please.
Yeah, this is Marika. We're having some issues in displaying the information correctly in Adobe Connect, but I've actually just posted the link of the wiki where I've just uploaded the slides. So for those that have difficulty viewing it, please go to the link and download it from there so you can follow along. And apologies for the distortion.
Oh, is it not working? Oh.
It's Don. Thanks for saying that. A few of us up here were thinking our computers were giving up after a full week at ICANN.
Yeah, that's interesting. The next question related to how complaints were handled. And so two providers indicated that they handle complaints the same as any other, and they don't treat it any differently than they would for any other domain-related complaint. Others provided specific examples of their practices. For example, they would ask that abuse be reported to abuse at the provider's email address. Some say that their complaints are monitored and escalated according to internal policies. For substantiated complaints, some reveal the identity of the registrant to the complainant or will cancel the service. Some request evidence of the illegal use of the domain name in order to assist in the investigation. And for malicious abuse complaints, they typically will provide, they will independently investigate and verify the allegations made. So these are just examples of different responses. It's not uniform across the board. And one provider will take action if it's also hosting the content. Any questions about this or comments? Go ahead.
Hi, it's Maria. Yeah, quick one. The final one there is it one provider will only take action if they're also hosting the content, or...
It was one provider commented that way. I mean, we didn't ask a specific question about how many people would do that. So, again, this information is not statistically significant. It's just illustrative.
Yeah. And actually, sorry, the other one I was wondering, exactly, it's kind of illustrative, and maybe we're just down to the small sample size, which is by no means a comment on the work done. How many people were still with the survey at
11.
After the first, okay, 11.
So 11. So what you're looking at from here on are the high-level summary of the 11 substantive comments we received. Kathy?
This may be something that we'll see in further slides, but where it says provider requests evidence or any evidence of the illegal use of the domain name to assist an investigation, was that a single, so this is only two providers responded on the complaint handling, and one of them said they do this. Is that the right way to interpret the slide?
It's just one of them describing their process. Okay. I invite you to actually read the more detailed summary. I was just trying to capture concepts for this presentation. Next slide, please. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yeah, Margie, Elliot and Ostukows. I think it's probably also important just in terms of the remit here that where there's a reference to what somebody will do in their hosting context, that's identified as being outside the purview of this, because there's a fundamentally different standard around what a registrar should do around a domain registration compared to what a hosting company should do around a hosted website. Thanks.
Correct.
Yeah, I'd really like to see that explicit wherever we're referencing hosting.
Okay, so next slide, please. And so then we asked whether the processes were automated or manual with respect to handling abuse inquiries, and predominantly they were manual, because it's difficult to just get a complaint and actually do something without having some human take a look at it and make an assessment. Any comments on this? Next slide, please. So we asked about UDRP or URS procedures. Generally, because the URS is so new, there wasn't a lot of information on the URS. Three indicated that they do follow the standard UDRP procedures. Several indicated that they immediately deactivate the service and inform the UDRP provider of the underlying registrant. And one indicated that they actually delete the domain name in order to avoid any negative publicity. Yeah, I was surprised to hear that.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, thank you, Steve Metallitz. On the preceding slide about automated versus manual, was there a question asked about the volume of abuse complaints? Because that might have an impact there.
No.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. We asked questions about the procedures to relay customer correspondence. And it depends upon the type of correspondence received. With regard to email, four responders automatically forward it to their customers. Three of them do it on a case-by-case basis. For example, they might filter the emails for spam, or they would look at the content and forward important communications. One indicated that they do not forward correspondence, and another one indicated that if you want to reach their customers, they have an online form related for that purpose. With respect to postal mail, one responder actually opens the postal mail, destroys the junk mail, and then takes reasonable steps to scan and forward the postal mail electronically, assuming that it's a reasonably sized package. On telephone, if a telephone call is received, one of them indicated that the caller would be informed about how to contact the administrative contact. Any questions or comments on this slide?
We're just commenting on the slide that we want people to go through our spam mail also and filter it out for us.
Okay, next slide, please. So then we asked whether it was automated or manual, the processing that they used to relay the correspondence. And you can see the breakdown on the slide where three were manual, three were both, and two were automatic. And one didn't do it at all. Okay, next slide, please. Customer support services, we asked about the procedures of how you get customer support. And so here's an example of the types of customer support that's out there. There might be a phone or email that's gives you access to the provider. One provider has a, what they call a console where the customer can activate or deactivate the service at will. Another one has a dedicated account manager accessible by phone or email or mail. Another has a customer service available by phone, email, and live chat. There's also online forms that can be used, such as contact us or contact owner or report abuse, which goes directly to the support team. One indicated that the support is provided by the domain name registrar that's for the domain name. And then another one provides online support to assist the customers and has a URL for that purpose. So you can see that there's a wide range of customer service approaches. I imagine they're related to the type of business model that the proxy or privacy service would have and what kind of customers they have. Any questions on this? Okay, next slide. Responding to correspondence. We asked the question about if there's a correspondence, does the service actually respond to it? Some services say that they do not respond. Instead, they just automatically forward the emails to the customer. One indicated that since the clients are seeking privacy, there's no need to forward the correspondence. Some will notify their customers and advise them of the risk of not responding and then the potential loss of the domain name if they violate the terms of service. Some will do both. They'll respond and forward to the client. In this case, it appeared that it was someone that has a large trademark client portfolio, and so they like to respond and tell the respondent that that they're forwarding it on, and so they will do both. Any questions on this or comments? Next slide. We asked a question about whether there was any validation done on the customer contact details. Three respondents that were registrars indicated they followed the 2013 RAA requirements for validating customer contact details. Two providers who were also registrars did not validate their customer contact details, but you may recall that that's not a requirement in the other versions of the RAA, and one indicated that they rely on a trusted relationship instead of validation because they have a direct relationship with their customers. Any questions? Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, what do you mean?
This is Steve Metallics.
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm sorry, I didn't know someone in the room wanted to ask a question.
It's fine, you can go, and then we'll go to the next person after you.
Thank you. Where did we get the information about whether the registrars had signed up to the 2013 RAA? My understanding was that the responses were supposed to be anonymous to this survey. I remember some discussion of that. Did you ask whether they were whether they had signed up to the 2013 RAA, or how did we know that?
They volunteered it. And so we're just reporting on what they... We weren't trying to look at this from a compliance perspective. This is just a general survey for policy purposes. Okay,
thank you.
Hi, it's Maria. So the last one says, one relied on existing trust relationships instead of validation. Is that... I guess what do you think they meant by that, or any ideas?
I assume it's probably the company that has a brand portfolio, so they might have a very close relationship with their clients, and know their customers, as opposed to perhaps a larger registrar that only deals with the online business and doesn't have that same kind of relationship with their customer. Next slide, please. So we asked about the conditions of service. We were trying to get at a sense for what kinds of terms and conditions apply to the service. Two indicated that they don't have any special requirements for the privacy and proxy services. They just use their standard terms and conditions. Four indicated that they did have specific conditions of purchase, and I've listed some of them here to try to explain what kinds of things that they ask for with respect to these kinds of services, such as a commitment to maintain accurate contact data, and they'll actually escrow their customers' contact data. They ask their customers to be responsible for infringement. They let the customer know that the provider will take all necessary steps to avoid legal or financial liability. The provider can at any time suspend or disable the domain name without or the service without liability. The provider indicates that they may reveal the customer contact who is information for any reason. And also they let their customers know that suspension or termination of the service will result in the immediate disclosure of their registrant's information in the who is or to the third party claimants that might be asking for that information. And some provide notification to their customers, or they endeavor to provide notification 24 hours before the service is disabled. Any questions or comments on this slide? Okay, next. Oh, go ahead, Marika.
No, this is Marika. Just one comment. If when taking questions from Steve, everyone can turn off their mics, because otherwise it creates feedback when we have people on the phone speaking and the microphones.
Okay. We also asked about what requirements the service places on the customer in order to retain the service. Again, two indicated that they don't have any special requirements except for the normal terms and conditions. One referenced the Whois data reminder policy. Another one requires a customer to update their contact data upon request, usually within 3 business days. Another requires response on request, and they, again, list a time period, in this case, 72 hours. Another one indicated that they follow the revalidation process as required under the 2013 RAA.
Do you have a sense if normal terms and conditions means their regular registrar terms and conditions or the normal terms and conditions for their privacy and proxy service?
They didn't have anything special for the privacy and proxy service, is my reading of the response. So if they are a registrar, I assume it's the same as the registration agreement, but not every respondent was a registrar. Next slide, please. So we asked about the response processing times. Email forwarding services generally take place within seconds. Telephone or fax responses are usually the same day. If they're doing the postal scan, like the opening the mail and scanning and sending it to their customer, it can take from 2 to 5 days. Abuse responses, generally we were seeing about 72 hours to respond to abuse complaints. Forwarding complaints ranged from 2 to 7 days. And then some indicated that they just don't have any service level agreement on response times. Any questions? Next slide, please. So we are asked about how they handle inquiries. One provider indicated that no correspondence is accepted, replied, or forwarded. So there's apparently no handling there. Another one indicated that all the queries are passed on regardless of the nature. Another one indicated that they would forward some of the communications as is, but they might also require their customer to take down the offending content, or they might publish the contact details if the service is using commercial services. Law enforcement requests, some treat them the same as others. Some have special procedures for law enforcement related requests and will forward them to their legal department. Any questions? Aubrey?
This is one where I, Aubrey Doria speaking. This is one where I got confused in that, were we expecting the proxy or privacy operator to be the one taking down offending content? When I was reading it, I didn't see how that was possible, but I was basically having difficulty with that concept.
I think we were just asking what the procedure was if there is a law enforcement related request. And so these are the responses that we received. We weren't assuming a response that I recall.
Kathy Kleiman, I wonder if this goes back to what Elliot was talking about, the difference between the domain name registrar and the hosting provider, hosting of the content, and the need to identify, even if it's the same company, the need to identify the different hat that's being worn on the issue.
Volker?
Well, speaking from our example, in some cases we may forward it and include a note that we require a certain action to be taken to be able to continue the service. As if that action is not taken, we would disable the service. If that action is taken, we would continue providing the for privacy service. That wouldn't such actions on behalf of the registrant could be taking down of the offending content by the registrant himself. So we wouldn't be able to do that, but we would require him to do so.
Any other questions or comments? Oh, go ahead, Don.
Let me, and I should have said this up front, if there are any questions or comments from people not on the working group, please. And I know some people have, but I probably should have made that clear. When we ask this, it's not just for working group members. I'm looking mainly at folks who are sitting in the back there.
Next slide, please. So we asked about the procedures for transfer, renewal, or suspension of the domain name or the service. Two providers indicated that their procedures are no different than what they would do for normal domain names that aren't involving a privacy or proxy service. One indicated that they issue a separate notice for expiration of the privacy service. The service is typically renewed automatically along with the domain name. With respect to registrar transfers, I think several indicated that they will only do registrar transfers if the privacy function is removed prior to the transfer request. This is among registrars. For a registrant transfer, they will keep the service in place as long as the new owner requests it and signs a new contract. And then for obvious infringement, one service indicated that they would suspend the domain name, contact the owner, and ask him to take appropriate action. within 5 days and confirm that they've done so. And if they don't respond in 5 days, they'll delete the domain name. Elliot?
Margie, I'm confused, and I'm sure it's me. This is in the case of a transfer renewal, a transfer or renewal request post-complaint?
Are you talking about the last point?
Well, it feels like the first 5 points there are just dealing with, you know, how a privacy and proxy service deal with transfer and renewal, and then the sixth one has introduced this new concept, and I don't understand.
It's a suspension. Yeah. So the we asked about all of those.
Oh, so that's just that's the others. Are, okay.
Right. Right. Next slide, please. We asked for reasons. Go ahead, Elliot.
Margie, so was the last point the only response that you got on suspension? Or that was unanimously made that point?
It's just where the responses came from. So they answered in that question related to suspension. I have a few more slides now that go into more detail. So there were several responses that dealt with termination and suspension.
Okay, so this is it's a sequential set of slides?
Yeah, oh. After these slides, you can. I think you'll see the kind of responses we received. Okay, next slide, please. So we asked them to identify the reasons that they might terminate the service. And so I've listed them on the next two slides. One would be obviously illegal use, a determination of whether an alleged breach of law or regulation has occurred. They'll terminate on the breach of their terms of use or non-payment of fees. They will terminate if there's a failure to update the content made available under the domain name upon request. UDRP might be a reason for termination, or a legal administrative action at a competent court or by a competent administrative body. Another reason might be compliance with applicable laws or regulations. Valid legal service of process. Let's go on to the next slide, and then we can flip between the two because the list keeps growing. Engaging in prohibited contract, breach of registration agreement. One even said anything that jeopardizes the operation of the service. They might terminate for technical failure or modifications or maintenance. In other words, if they're having some technical issues. On 30 days notice, for any reason, they might terminate the service. They might terminate the service if it's being used to conceal illegal, illicit, harmful or activities such as spam, viruses, worms, and other types of computer programs. If there's a notice of a claim or a complaint like a UDRP, they might terminate the service. Many of them indicated to avoid legal liability or financial loss would be a reason to terminate the service. And one had it tied to commercial purposes that they would terminate the service if the domain name was being used for commercial purposes. So are there any questions about these two slides? These are just many issues that were raised in these responses as reasons for termination of the service or suspension of the service.
Hi, Alex Deacon with a newbie question. I'm just curious, are these terms like termination and suspension, are they well known and defined? Are they used interchangeably? Are they different?
I think it varies. I mean, perhaps we could ask the registrars in the room whether they treat suspension differently than termination. Volker, do you have a thought on that?
Well, with our service, suspension is termination because suspension of the privacy service usually means that the service is terminated and the real Whois data is displayed.
Graham Bunton, I don't know how you could suspend a Whois privacy without effectively terminating it.
Okay. Yeah, and I guess when you're saying service here, I assume you're meaning the privacy service, not the, yeah. Yeah, so just so I'm clear again, this is it's more form than anything else. You're just sort of word for word putting out here what these people said. You know, a couple of these don't make sense to me, and okay, that's great. So that's just who knows, and who knows what the respondent said. Again, going back to my previous point, if you go back two slides.
Go back two slides.
So, Margie, was that the only example of somebody who responded on suspension procedures?
I'd have to refer back to the document. It's posted.
Okay. It just strikes me as strange that that's the one that's, you know, sort of highlighted here as the, you know, it makes it look like that's the predominant result or the only result or the significant result. Mm-hmm. And that really surprises me.
Okay. So let me get that information for you. I'd have to dig into the document.
Yeah, yeah. If you could, because, yeah. I mean, if this is going to be a public document that's going to form part of this record, you know, to me, that's a very misleading bullet, you know, unless it's clearly supported by the data.
Yeah, my assumption is there's other reasons as well.
So right. Then I think maybe a separate slide and a list of those reasons, just as you've done for termination, et cetera.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Kathy.
Can we go back to the slide that we were on, so two ahead? So let me check, and anyone who's running a service, please feel free to help me. So if someone has infected, I'm looking at the bullet point that says spam, viruses, worms, and or other harmful computer programs, so botnets. So someone's infected someone else's website, and the result, is there any process? Was any question asked about whether the registrant was informed, notified, or do they terminate without kind of letting the registrant know that someone else has taken over or planted something on their website?
This is Graham Bunton. I can't say definitively, but I suspect that's something we would ask the requester to take to the hosting company.
Any other questions or comments on the reasons for termination? Elliot?
Well, I just want to slightly modify Graham's point. It depends where that's coming from as well. If that's coming from, there are security circles where there's a very high level of credibility and, that'll cut. So there might be a senior security person at, a senior security institution who's speaking to some of our senior security people. And in extreme cases like that, you know, if we're told about something that's going on that's really, quite urgent, then we will take that down. And there can be things like that being taken down. But that's only in very extreme circumstances. And what you'd see here, where it's really about privacy, then typically then it's going to be the straight procedure that Graham describes. But I do want to make sure that, you know, we all want to leave room for these extremely urgent cases for all of us, because they they really help the internet.
Elliot, can I follow up?
Sure.
So it is the difference between taking down, which I can understand, you don't want that botnet to continue, so you want to take it down, but the revealing of the group, the human rights organization on which that botnet was planted, does that, can you help me out? Are those tied
together?
Sure.
So when you're going to have those extreme circumstances, they're very bespoke. You know, that's a very hands-on process. So if you had that, that's going to be senior security entity, you know, to person on the phone, getting people all hours of the night with cell phones and things like that. So that's a very, very hands-on process.
Thank you.
And that's consistent with the question we had before, whether it was manual or automated. I mean, when you deal with abuse things, that's manual across the board from the responses we received. Next slide, please. So then we asked specific questions on what are the reasons to reveal or to publish customer contact details. And these are similar to the list we just discussed. If there's obvious illegal use or on receipt of a valid, verifiable, locally issued court order that complies with our local legislation. This one was interesting. In the event a direct relative of the registrant requests the information, the customer's identity is revealed to the relative. So I was a bit surprised to see that one. Legal claim or UDRP might be a reason. Compliance with a registry request. And then infringement on the legal rights of a third party or any third party trademark or trade name. Any questions or comments on this?
Go ahead, Steve.
Are you on
mute? I'm sorry, this is Steve. And I'm sorry about the echo, but again, the question about whether reveal or publish, was a distinction made there? Because we've kind of wrestled with this in the group as to whether there's should be different standards if you're revealing something to a complainant versus suspending the proxy service altogether so that the world at large has access to this information. Was that drawn out in the question, or were they lumped together?
They were lumped together, but I think we could go back, and the responses are generally pretty specific, so I might be able to recategorize the information if it's helpful to this working group.
Since my first joke went nowhere, I will attempt a second joke and say that I was very angry when they turned over my identity to my mother about my Minecraft server. A little better.
Next slide, please. So we asked about escrow, how many of them escrow their customers' data, and 6 said they did, and 3 said they didn't. Okay, next slide. Logging of requests. We asked if information related to relaying the relayed correspondence or reveal requests or subsequent actions taken, whether that was actually retained. 7 said yes, and 2 said no. And then we asked a further question that if you did retain, log this information, would you ever provide it to a third party? 5 said no, and 3 said yes. Any questions or comments on this topic? Okay, next slide.
Well, this, Steve, I would just point out again that there are more responses on the right than there are on the left. 7 people said they logged it, and then you have 8 responses about how they would share it. So how does that?
Yeah, I'll go back and check that.
Thank you.
That's the end of the summary. Again, these are really high-level summary of the responses. The document we submitted to you is 14 pages, and I think you'll get a lot more flavor for some of the answers that were provided. And I have a couple action items that you guys asked to try to clarify some points, and I'll do that and send it to your list. Okay? Any general questions or comments? Maria?
Yeah, it's Maria speaking. Yeah, just kind of a broad comment, really, in response. I know it's just an illustrative survey, but I found it actually tremendously educational and useful in terms of the granularity that I know the registrars are very familiar with, but I actually learned an awful lot. And the main thing I take from it is the amount of variety of response, to all sorts of things, but particularly to alleged misuse or abuse. It makes me think, but I could be wrong, and I'm happy to be corrected, but that one of the big tasks of this working group is to develop, a certain amount of uniformity of response that ticks all of the boxes from all the way, on one end of the threshold, from completely inadequate or non-responses to responses to alleged misuse that just shut something down without any process at all. So I think there's a spectrum there of variety that we should be looking to try and narrow down a bit. But then it also occurred to me that then, just, and I wonder, maybe the registrars, could give some feedback on this. Will we be creating a level of granularity and uniformity in this one small area of a registrar's interaction, or a proxy and privacy service provider's interaction with their customers that we don't have otherwise? Not necessarily that it's problematic, but I was surprised there was so much variety, and what we are going to do going to create a really kind of a narrow channel of uniformity. And the final thing really was that we also need to look at how those kind of responses and reactions are going to be when we're dealing with lawyers, for example, who are providing proxy and privacy services. We pretty much have to define the process that we define, I think, has to be defined in that way for them as well. So that's just kind of a broad set of responses, really, but I think we've certainly got a lot of work to do. And it was, I found it a really great piece of work. Thank you.
If I could comment, I really want to thank the registrars that participated in this and the privacy and proxy service providers, because I was very pleased with the amount of detail we received. And I think, you know, it took a lot of time to prepare these responses. So, you know, thank you to all of you in the room that participated.
Yeah, Margie, do you know if any of the participants were law firms?
I don't think they were, no.
Was any outreach done to law firms?
We just published it on the announcement page, so no, we didn't.
So, you know, what might be helpful is, you know, I mean, there's probably, you know, certainly in the tens of thousands, I'd be surprised if it's not hundreds of thousands of names in the namespace, and probably across, you know, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of lawyers, privacy and proxy services provided for clients around domain registration. And those tend to be much smaller in smaller number of registrations per provider. I'm wondering if there's any subsequent or follow-up, you know, outreach planned into that particular segment of privacy and proxy services.
Be a good question to ask the lawyers in the room.
Why the lawyers? Aren't you? I mean, who's responsible for grabbing the? You know, who's responsible for generating these questionnaires and?
Oh, so yeah, the EWG published it, and we did an announcement on the website of ICANN and sent emails to the various SOs and ACs, and these are the responses we received.
So you know what we're worried about as registrar. Is you know, we're going to have these privacy and proxy providers, law firms, who are going to be likely, because the outreach isn't reaching them, unregistered privacy and proxy providers, and we're the ones that are going to have to go out and deal with them and enforce, and that's going to be very, very complicated. So, you know, the more, and maybe our friends in the IPC could really help getting this out through the various bar associations, et cetera, why don't I wait for the people I'm talking to finish their sidebar? And yeah, so, you know, it might be very helpful if
this is Steve Metallics. Could I?
You could interrupt me, Steve. Sure.
Member of the IPC. I think for the most part, these concerns about lawyers are not within the scope of what we're looking at here, because the requirement in the 2013 RAA is basically for proxy or privacy services that are offered in connection with registration. So either by a registrar, a reseller, or that has a contractual relationship with a service provider. Now, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but that's basically what.
Steve, if I can interrupt you, I can interrupt you. So then, what you would then simply create is a move by registrars to use that loophole to provide proxy and privacy services through exactly the same form of registration that covers any privacy and proxy service that you don't see covered by this. Look, at the end of the day, the facts are that thousands of lawyers across tens or hundreds of thousands of registrations are providing these same privacy and proxy services. And you know, it's going to be
no, they're not providing
for us.
Let's not have a two-person debate here.
Great.
I saw some reaction from some registrar folks to something was just said, so I'd like to refer it.
Let's go, James.
Am I misreading that you had a reaction to something that Steve said about the nature of the...
Yeah, I don't think that is correct. I think that's currently correct for the temporary specification for privacy and proxy services, but once this is an active program, any registrar that becomes aware of a proxy registration, whether it's affiliated with the registrar or not, or offered in conjunction with registration services or not, it's just any level of awareness puts the obligation is on us to then only accept registrations from accredited services. So if we become aware of a service that's not accredited, then we have to take action on the names. That's my reading of the 2013 RAA. That's current. I see some ICANN legal folks
nodding. But this is so Steve is correct, but it is part of the temporary placeholder policy that we have today, and would not be correct in the ongoing policy.
I mean, it's fairly easy to do. Every country has a national bar association. You'd write to them.
Volker, did you have something?
I think James took care of that.
Yeah, no, if I could, you know, I think Christina's point is a great one. And, you know, I really do want to see the legal community embracing this as an opportunity. I think, you know, a high tide rises all boats here. I don't want this to be seen as a negative consequence. I think it's a real positive one because we have problems, across the board. You know, believe me, one of the truest things is that criminals have lawyers too, often the best and most expensive lawyers. So, you know, I think that, we really want to raise the bar for everyone here, and I really would love to see this embraced. Thanks.
Stephanie? I just want to reiterate something that I've said numerous times, I think, so I'm sorry to be repetitive, but it strikes me that this is fundamentally non-competitive if you do not have the same rules for all. You're disrupting the marketplace, you're forcing the traffic somewhere else, you're depriving accredited registrars of business because they can go to a non-accredited lawyer. They also get solicitor-client privilege when they go to a lawyer. You have to find a way to get rid of solicitor-client privilege in the lawyer's services, or you don't have a level playing field. That seems to me very self-evident, and if that isn't our scope, then we should go back and ask for that scope.
You can add that into the request for information that you send to the National Bar Association.
James?
Just pointing out that, you know, existing services may have to modify their structure or their product based on the outcome of this program, or new services might innovate and set up differently. For example, one of them could convert to becoming a legal services fund and therefore have a privileged relationship with its privacy customers, and that's one possible outcome of this program.
Maria?
Yeah, it's Maria speaking. A lot of registrations potentially, you know, from all the privacy and proxy registrations can be the subject of misuse or abuse. So I think we should probably investigate and make sure we have a clear legal picture of what the RAA, specifications are in conjunction with this, and really understand where our scope is. But. You know, I hear so much about accuracy and misuse that I think we should go after all avenues. And as someone who previously worked for a law society, actually the Law Society of England in Wales, there are also a number of kind of regional and semi-global peak organisations, as some of you know, for the legal profession. And I wonder, should we even just give them the opportunity to proactively, you know, let them know we're doing some work here and would like to get their thoughts on, you know, what is a lightweight way for them to engage with us and to give them, you know, or for them to give us some of their expertise and their experience.
Claudia DeGangi, IPC. I just wanted to clarify Elliot's question. If you're referring to...
Excuse me, could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Claudio DeGangi, IPC. I'm just trying to understand the question a little bit better, Elliot. Are you referring to a situation where a law firm registers a domain name in its own name and is listed as the registrant, or it's providing a service, or when you do the who is, it comes up and it says domains by proxy, or it shows the actual proxy service, which is, I'm just trying to understand that nuance there. Thanks.
Sure. It's a law firm who's registering names that are on behalf of clients. Look, when it's what it, you know, I don't think anybody has to use the term by proxy or privacy in the actual registration. It's typically when a law firm does it, it's the name of the law firm. It says nothing underneath, but it is on behalf of a client. And it's not tough to know for us when we have incoming around that because, you know, it's a content website or it's something that's clearly not in the in the practice of the law firm, and that's quite a regular practice. You know, it would be done by lawyers who manage any type of registration or even just the intellectual property underneath the registration on behalf of registrants. So it's a simple, you know, as this is, proxy or trust relationship. You know, separation, you know, for the lawyers in the room, separation between legal and beneficial ownership or title.
Observers, respond to that?
Greg Shatton from Reed Smith Intellectual Property Constituency. It seems that if we're going to expand this to ad hoc privacy proxy relationships, you would also want to expand it to web design firms, web hosting firms, advertising agencies, marketing agencies. You may also want to look at the practice of individuals registering company websites in their own name, whether by accident or on purpose. At some point, the question of whether this is really privacy or proxy or just some sort of, you know, inaccurate registration, you know, becomes an issue as well, whether they're intending to provide a privacy or proxy service or if there is really a requirement here that if any registrant other than the user of the domain name, if there's not an actual identity that's being considered privacy proxy services, I think that needs to be considered because then that becomes a very broad definition. Thank you.
You know, if I could, I think that's exactly the point. That's not expanding the scope of this. I think it's identifying and clarifying the scope of this. At the very beginning of the request for this term in the RAA, what was pointed out very clearly by me and others, but by me vigorously and regularly, was that it's exactly this. You know, let me give you another word for web designers: resellers. We have thousands of web designers who are resellers. Something that I said over and over and over again before, during the course of the RAA negotiation, as the IPC was repeatedly asking for this, was that that is the practice. That's what's done. It's not done evilly. It's done in the normal course of business. It's done in the normal course of business for web designers, just like it's done in the normal course of business for lawyers. If we're going down this road, and we have now, it's in the RAA, this group is constituted. I would say this is not expanding, this is exactly including and making it fulsome and appropriate.
Let me jump in here. I'd like to give people, particularly in the audience, who might have questions or concerns that they wanted to raise, a chance to do it. We've got less than 10 minutes here. So I'm glad to continue this discussion, but I wanted to make sure that anybody had a chance to be heard on other issues they wanted to bring up.
Don, it's Claudia. I just wanted to just follow on what Elliot was saying. I mean, there might be a distinction. I mean, lawyers have a fiduciary legal duty with their clients, which may not exist in some of these other examples that you're talking about. I mean, I've seen plenty of cases where registrars just list they register the name under their own name instead of listing it as a proxy or a privacy service. They're the registrant. In reality, it's really their customer that's the registrant. So I think there could be some distinctions that might require, you know, as a group to take a closer look at it. Just a suggestion.
Wait, Elliot, hang on a second.
I'm sorry, Don.
Elliot, please, I've asked.
Yes.
If anybody else has any other questions, if they don't, come on back up.
That doesn't bode well. I think it might be helpful to have a better sense of the potential scope to the extent that we can identify it before we go down the rabbit hole. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, Elliot, you've indicated that Two Cows can tell when it's a law firm registering a domain name in its name, but clearly on behalf of a third party. I think it would be helpful to have a better sense of kind of, you know, either quantitatively as an absolute or proportion, what kind of number we're talking about to the extent that you can do that, and to the extent that other registrars can equally immediately identify those registrations. Only because I want to make sure that if there is the, and it sounds as if this is the direction we could head, that there is a decision made that we're going to develop a request for information that's going to go out to every national and regional bar association in the world, and all of the advertising agencies and website, you know, developing associations in the world. I think we need to make sure that that effort is proportionate to the issue that we're talking about, only because I think we need to then be able to affirmatively say, we recognize that this is X percentage of, you know, proxy registrations globally. Nonetheless, we think it's sufficiently important that we're going to devote all of this time and energy to that. You know, I have my own personal view as to where this is going, and, you know, I'm sure James would be delighted to know that to the extent I ever register domain names on clients' behalfs, I do it under DBP for that reason. So, you know, I would just encourage us that if we are going to go down this very long path, that we make sure that the effort is proportionate to the potential outcome.
So, I'm glad to always meet a customer and someone who's willing to say yes and hold up their hand and say, I am one of the 10 million people that have plunked down the payment for that service. It is a good service. I use it for my own names as well. But I wanted to just maybe step back a bit. I think that these points that we've raised are important, and I think that Elliot's points are particularly worthy of, you know, spending some time on, because what it is a question of boundaries, and right now we don't have any, and I think that, you know, it opens up the question that if we were to make some sort of determination, Christina, that some of these are problematic and worthy of policy attention, and some are, you know, as you said, not really worthy of the effort because they're smaller or more fringe type or, you know, less frequently occurring in the wild, that we could draw boundaries there. We just need to recognize that whatever bad habit or actor or abusive behavior we're going to do is just going to move to the other side of that line. And that what we're doing, what Domains by Proxy is doing to serve good customers like Christina, is just going to become a little more difficult, a little more expensive, a little more involved, and that the actual nefarious behavior is just going to say, well, I guess I'm a law firm now, or I guess I'm a web developer now, or whatever group we draw a box around and say you're outside the fence of this policy. You know, that's my concern. And it's really more of a concern for almost all consensus policy that we develop that tries to attack abuse or abusive behaviors. Bad guys don't follow policy.
And James has just said some of what I might want to say, but I would like to pull us back up to what actually is the purpose of this particular group, other than to fill in something that was required under the RIAA, which strikes me as somewhat of a patchwork approach to what is a problem. In the EWG, we were lucky enough to have a kind of tabula rasa approach. So if you look at the three goals, accountability, more accuracy in the data, and better protection of privacy, then it's very clear with those three purposes that you have to come up with mechanisms in this group that are going to cover the waterfront. Otherwise, it, exactly as James says, you're going to regulate the good guys and allow the bad guys to make a fortune. Thanks.
With apologies, I have to leave for my next thing, but I think that to the extent we do reach out to the ABA and its sister organizations around the world, one of the issues is the qualitative issue about whether or not the relationship by its nature is a privacy or proxy service relationship. Attorneys like to think that what they do is special and dates back to Henry II. And so I think that if we go down this path, we need to make sure that we ask not only how many of your members do this and, you know, how many complaints have been filed with various, you know, bar association complaint boards and things like that, but also you know, for the nefarious behavior, but also, you know, do you view this as the same type of service, or is the legal profession different from a privacy or proxy service? And then lastly, what are the bars to entry for the bad guys who are going to cross the line? Is it easy for a proxy service, for example, to become a law firm, or is that an unlikely outcome? Things of that nature. I apologize for leaving, but thank you very much. I think this was extremely productive, and Margie, especially that survey, was just terrific. Thank you.
You know, no apology necessary, because we're all going to have to leave in about 90 seconds. I appreciate everybody's participation, attendance, and then participation. And Margie, this was outstanding for feeding our discussions. Really appreciate it. I've been going through these throat things during the meeting here. Again, thanks for your participation. A couple of really interesting and useful points have been raised that we are going to pursue on our next call, or on the email list in between. Our next call is going to be April 8th. For those who weren't aware, didn't see the note, and we will take it from there. Again, appreciate your time.
Thanks, Don.